One of the reasons why Donald Trump is now once again running head-to-head with Joe Biden is that a lot of voters are concerned about the dominance that these ideas have over mainstream institutions. More Americans right now think the Democratic Party is too extreme than think that the Republican Party is too extreme.
That's political scientist Yasha Monk, warning that abrasive identity politics could cost Democrats the 2024 election and return Donald Trump to the White House. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line podcast.
I like to say that I'm a democracy crisis hipster. I was worried about the crisis of our democratic institutions before it was cool.
Yasha Monk has written extensively about the rise of populism, the decline of democracy, and the right's turn toward authoritarianism. Now he's sounding an urgent alarm about the excesses of the left in his latest book, The Identity Trap.
After 2016, it became very difficult for people in mainstream institutions, and especially in progressive spaces, to criticize bad ideas on the left without being portrayed as secretly trying to assist Donald Trump.
A German-born Jew whose ancestors were persecuted by the Nazis, Monk is a left-leaning political scientist, a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and a contributing writer for The Atlantic.
I certainly grew up with a deep consciousness of the fact that societies which seem tolerant and stable can go very badly wrong. And when they fall apart, the consequences for many people are deadly.
The Identity Trap traces the evolution of an ideology that Monk says has taken over the American left and examines its potentially destructive consequences.
Why is this a trap?
I think at scale, it's much more likely to produce racists and white supremacists, to turn our society into a zero-sum struggle between different ethnic blocs.
But does he agree with Republicans who want to fight back by banning ideas like critical race theory?
That is, as the founding fathers would have said, a cure worse than the disease. That's not going to recreate a culture of free speech. It's simply going to balkanize America into two halves, in which in one half you're allowed to say one set of things, and the other half you're allowed to say a different set of things. I want an America in which in all of it you're allowed to speak your mind.
Yasha Monk, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you so much.
Your great-grandparents were murdered for being Jewish. And the Holocaust claimed the lives of nearly your entire extended family from your grandparents' generation. Nevertheless, your grandparents stayed in Europe, and you grew up as a German Jew. How has your family's history shaped your views about the debate over confronting discrimination and injustice in the United States?
So my family has been in the wrong place at the wrong time for four or five generations.
Yeah.
And I certainly grew up with a deep consciousness of the fact, with a deep awareness of the fact that societies which seem tolerant and stable can go very badly wrong. And when they fall apart, the consequences for many people are deadly. And so when I think about this political moment, I think that one of the key tasks we have is to sustain these ethnically and religiously diverse democracies like the United States, make sure that they stay prosperous, they stay tolerant, and that we can overcome the historical injustices that still characterize parts of them.
You were raised in an intellectual tradition that you characterize as universalist leftism. Unpack that. What is universalist leftism?
So my grandparents were born in shtetls in what's today the Ukraine, what at the time was the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And they were marked, even before the Holocaust, by the kind of discrimination they experienced. And they became communists in the hope that this ideology would do away with the kind of discrimination that they'd experienced, that we would prioritize what we have in common, the interests we share as humans, over the things that set us apart. Now, it didn't work out that way. The communist regimes that they helped to build up in Poland in the 1940s and 1950s turned on them. And they and my parents had to flee Poland in 1968 because they were Jewish. But I do think that this aspiration to recognize injustice based on group, but to build a society that is less structured by the kind of group to which you belong, has for a long time characterized a lot of the left. And it's why I still think of myself as being on the left.
Who are individuals in the Western tradition that most typify or embody the intellectual tradition of universalism?
Well, I think you can think of this as an intellectual tradition that runs from people like Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln through Martin Luther King Jr. And I would say someone like Barack Obama typified it as well. All of them were perfectly conscious of the injustices, different kinds of injustices of their time and day. And all of them wanted to build an America where the group to which you belong comes to be less predictive of your life outcomes, less predictive of your opportunities, less predictive of how we treat each other. Not because we ignore the ways in which it structures our society, but because we build a society where it comes to matter less, because we've overcome some of these, hopefully many of these injustices.
You've spent recent years in your career focused on the rise of the illiberal right, but your latest work of scholarship, this book, The Identity Trap, examines a shift in the intellectual left from embracing universalism, as you just describe it, to now organizing around a separatist ideology that emphasizes distinct identity groups like race and gender and sexual orientation. Explain how the left or parts of the left have come to reject universalism and take on this new ideology.
Yeah. So I like to say that I'm a democracy crisis hipster. I was worried about the crisis of our democratic institutions before it was cool. And I've spent a lot of the last decade warning about the threat of far-right populists, whether it's Donald Trump in the United States or people like Recep Erdogan in Turkey or Narendra Modi in India. And I remain very concerned about them. At the same time, I have also seen how many of my friends and colleagues, big parts of the left, big parts of academia, and many mainstream institutions have, in part as a response, rejected the kind of universalist tradition we've been talking about, adopted a new set of ideas about race and gender and sexual orientation that promises to fight against injustice in the most uncompromising and radical way. But I fear that in key ways, it turns out to be a trap, that it makes it harder for progressive institutions to pursue their important missions, that it has led us to public policies that make it harder for members of minority groups to get the educational skills that they need, and that politically it ends up empowering rather than weakening those kind of far-right groups.
I mean, you point to in your book a disillusionment with the civil rights era progress as one of the seminal moments in Derrick Bell's intellectual journey. Derrick Bell, the African-American legal scholar, most credited with the development of critical race theory as a legal theory. Why the break? I mean, was it based on, to your mind, to your thinking, disillusionment with progress after the civil rights era?
Yes. And one of the things that I enjoyed as I was researching this book is to learn more about the intellectual influences on what generally I think is a novel ideology. And it makes me understand how its thinkers ended up in the place they were. Derrick Bell is an African-American lawyer who did heroic work for the NAACP in the 1960s, desegregating schools and businesses and other institutions throughout the American South and beyond. But he grew frustrated with those efforts, in part for very understandable reasons. He said that sometimes the clients whose behalf he worked on hoped to go to a better high school or an integrated high school, but by the time that he won their court cases, they had graduated high school, so they could no longer take advantage of that victory. And so he came to agree with what had always been the segregationist critique of civil rights law. He explicitly acknowledges this, but he came to agree with segregationist senators who had said, these civil rights lawyers running around the South, they're not really working on behalf of their clients. They just want to impose this ideology of integration on us. And so Bell himself came to think that in key ways, judgments like Brown versus Board of Education, the key Supreme Court case that integrated schools, may have been a mistake. But in certain contexts, we should have opted for schools that were separate, but quote unquote, truly equal. He said that it's time to reject what he called the defunct racial equality ideology of the civil rights movement.
In other words, the ideas or the promises of universalism didn't deliver and were somehow farcical.
Yes, because he felt that integration had not delivered the goods as much as promised, which is, I think, true as a historical claim. It made huge progress, but not all the progress that we would have wanted it to make. He said, well, perhaps the right solution to this is to make how people are treated explicitly depend on the kind of group of which they are part, but inverting sort of who gets treated better and who gets treated worse. But the skepticism about the progress, I think, went beyond what is defensible. He was right in many of his criticisms, but he concluded that American racism is permanent, that America in the year 2000 continued to be as racist as it was in 1950 or 1850, that perhaps the form that racism took had changed, but the substance of it and the magnitude of it had not changed. And that, I think, is a historical misassessment.
This new ideology has noble intentions, as you recognize. The intention is to cure persistent racial inequality in the West, but by hyper-focusing on identities of groups. Why is this a trap?
Perhaps I can start answering this question with a story. In researching this book, I spoke to a woman called Kyla Posey, an African-American educator who lives in the suburbs of Atlanta, and who requested that her daughter be able to go to a particular class because she liked the teacher. And the principal said, yes, of course, no problem, send in your request. And then when Kyla Posey said which teacher it was, the principal suddenly demurred and didn't seem to want to go along with that request. And Kyla eventually got impatient, said, what's going on here? And the principal said, well, that's not the black class. Your daughter can't go to that class. Now, you might think this is the kind of story about racial segregation that we've just been talking about, one that recalls the 1960s and 1970s. But actually, that principal is a black woman, and she is a progressive. She has bought into a new pedagogical trend, which says that a good education should teach children to think of themselves primarily as racial beings, that even if a 7-8-year-old child is well integrated in their classroom, has many friends, if there's not a sufficient number of same race students in that classroom, then that is a problem for her development. And so we see now in many elite private schools around the country, teachers come into classroom in the third grade, in the second grade, in the first grade, and splitting kids up by their race, saying that black kids are going to go to one classroom and Asian kids are going to go to another classroom, and Latino kids are going to go to a third classroom and white kids are going to go to a fourth. So why is this a trap? Why is this counterproductive? Well, one of the things I'm worrying about is what will happen to the white kids. And I don't worry that they're going to be uncomfortable. It's fine to be uncomfortable in your education sometimes. I worry that everything I've learned from history and from social science teaches that which group you identify with is really malleable. But once you say, this is my group, and that over there is another group, you're going to treat the members of your group much better. And you'll often treat the members of the other group very badly. So the hope might be to turn these white kids into great anti-racist activists who declaim their white privilege. I think at scale, it's much more likely to produce racists and white supremacists, to turn our society into a zero-sum struggle between different ethnic blocks.
How pervasive is this problem?
I think it is now very pervasive. These educational practices are present in many schools.
How many schools? Have you quantified this with data?
No, there's no data exactly on this, but if you talk to teachers in schools, if you talk to parents in schools, I see this all the time. This morning I was interviewed by a journalist who said, oh yes, this is happening in the school that my children go to. You see it at the university level, but you also see it in public policy.
You know, these ideas, the ideas of Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw, many of these ideas have been, you know, in the academy, in think tanks for several years, but you write in your book how they have now mainstreamed, how they are more prevalent in schools, as the story you just exemplified, but also in corporate America. Mm. So how did this become part of the mainstream, as you claim?
It's a really striking story. Kimberly Crenshaw, one of the key figures in the founding of this movement, wrote a paper commemorating the 20th anniversary of critical race theory in 2011. And what she said was, you know, our ideas have become influential in parts of university, but we're really marginal to society as a whole. Barack Obama was just elected president. He disagrees with the core tenets, fundamentally disagrees with the core tenets of critical race theory, and our prospect of having public influence is very low. And then over the course of the next decade, that changed completely. So how did that happen? I think there's three things that went on here. The first is the importance of social media on Facebook and Twitter, but also on platforms like Tumblr, which encouraged people to experiment with their identity, to define themselves by their identity, and then created a kind of popularized version of these ideas that held the peace between these different identity groups. The second element is that by 2010, universities were awash in these ideas. Academics, but also university administrators, were deeply convinced by them. And so students who went, especially through Ivy League colleges and elite universities, were being taught these ideas in the seminar room, but also in orientations and other kinds of contexts. And they started to go into the corporate world, into the nonprofit world, into media. And you see these changes happening fastest where you have a lot of young employees who come from elite universities. And then the third step, which was crucial, was the election of Donald Trump. The scholarly literature shows that one key thing for the functioning of groups is that they listen to in-group dissenters, people within the group who say, hey, perhaps we're going the wrong direction here. And that usually works pretty well until groups have the perception of an external threat. Well, Donald Trump, for good reason, was perceived as that external threat by people. And under those conditions, the in-group dissenter isn't listened to anymore, but rather branded as a traitor, somebody who's secretly running interference for the other side. And so after 2016, it became very difficult for people in mainstream institutions, and especially in progressive spaces, to criticize bad ideas on the left without being portrayed as secretly trying to assist Donald Trump.
Give me some examples of how this has shown up, the identity synthesis has shown up in, aside from, I mean, you just told the story about it in Georgia, the school there. How has it shown up in corporate America? I know you talked to CEOs. What have they told you?
So one conversation I've had for the last 5 years repeatedly with people who are in ordinary jobs, with people who are famous figures in media, with people who are politicians, including United States senators, and with CEOs, they might have expressed the kind of view that I've expressed so far in this conversation. And then they leaned forward a little bit and said, of course, I would never say this publicly. And I worry about that, because it's not good for the country when people say one thing in private and another thing in public. And I think it is fueling part of a crisis of confidence in our institutions, because people reasonably surmise that those who are in power, those who are running the important institutions in the country, say one thing in public to them on TV and another thing among friends over lunch.
I want to ground this in something a little bit more concrete.
Well, let me give you one example. Many of the people who helped to found this tradition, I think, are very sophisticated thinkers and theorists, people like Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw, whom I disagree deeply, but who I enjoyed reading and learned from. There's also been some popularizers of these ideas who I think are rather less sophisticated. Ibram X. Kendi shot to fame with his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, claiming that every person, every institution, every action is either racist or anti-racist. There's no such thing as being not racist. This conversation is either racist or anti-racist. A bowling club is either racist or anti-racist. I think that that is oversimplifying the world. But he became so prominent and so prestigious. He won tens of millions of dollars in donations to write an academic center, that it was very hard to criticize him. I know for journalists who tried to write pieces critiquing his work, and those pieces were killed. It felt impossible to do that. Well, 3 years later, it turns out that this academic center has not produced any research, but his own staff at the center is deeply upset with the mismanagement at it. But we've wasted those resources, which could have gone to important causes, perhaps for financing public defenders of high quality, for people in need of representation in the legal system or any number of other important causes. We've wasted those funds. And now suddenly, as the scandal is unfolding, people are coming out of woodwork and saying, well, perhaps these ideas were never particularly sophisticated in the first place. Why do we get this rapid swing in mood? Why for 3 years were people sitting on those articles and unable to formulate those critiques? And only now with the scandal can they be published. I don't think that that's a sign of a very healthy public sphere.
Why do you think that's the case?
Because these ideas have come to have an unhealthy hold over public discussion in mainstream institutions in the United States. Because there would be, in magazines that wanted to run these stories, some senior editor or sometimes young staff that said, we don't like this story. We're upset if this story runs. Because of things like we saw recently in an organization called TED, producing viral talks and videos in which a young Black intellectual was invited to give a talk. And when the staff at the organization said, we are upset by this talk, we feel this is attacking our identity, even though the speaker himself was Black, and therefore put enormous pressure on the founder of the organization not to release this talk.
So what should the CEOs be saying in public that they're not saying?
Well, I think, first of all, they should be saying, if you work at a shipping company, people shouldn't be proselytizing and talking about politics in the office. That's fine. But if you work in a newsroom or if you work in an organization devoted to ideas worth spreading, as it says, you have to tolerate that not everybody's going to agree with you. That's part of the deal of what you sign up for if you work at CNN or if you work at TED. And you don't get a veto over what the organization does and publishes. It's fine, by the way, to have explicitly progressive organizations. If the mission of your magazine, of your organization is, we want to agitate for progressive causes, great. But if you're saying that you're open to any ideas worth spreading, that you actually want to be an honest broker for different kinds of ideas, you can't make yourself subject to the veto of your junior staff.
We saw the CEO of Netflix apologize to employees after defending politically incorrect comedian Dave Chappelle. Even though he refused to take down the special episode of Dave Chappelle, he then apologized to employees for how he handled it. What is the dynamic of the internal activism at these companies that has created a fear from the executives?
Yeah. Well, so it's a combination of internal and external activism in many of those cases. So there's the Slack channels mm-hmm. in which people en masse express their displeasure with something that is happening at Netflix or in one of those companies. It creates an atmosphere in which there's not just one person being attacked, but anybody who defends that person or defends the importance of platforming these ideas becomes attacked themselves. And so people who actually are in favor of running this stand-up special or hosting this talk decide it's better not to speak up. And then, of course, it's combined with external pressure so that you plant media stories in mainstream outlets that say, well, you know, this organization is platforming this problematic person or this problematic content, and there's this group within the company that's very upset, and so it leads to very bad publicity.
You talk about a push, especially among elite academic institutions, for white people to take responsibility for their whiteness and for their privilege. What concerns you about this trend?
But what concerns me about this trend is that we need to build solidarity with each other. We need to create a society in which I understand more about the struggles and the injustices faced by people who are not born into the same kind of group, and in which we're able to sustain a common American identity, which recognizes the ways in which we're different, but also says that because we're citizens of the same country, we help each other. And if some injustice happens to you, I'm not just deferring to a judgment about how to remedy it. I want to remedy it for my own reasons, because it violates the vision of a kind of country in which I want to live. And what I worry about particularly in those educational contexts like elementary schools, is that we're teaching people to think of themselves first and foremost as a member of their identity groups. And that inspires all of the mechanisms of preferring the in-group over the out-group that humans seem universally prey to. So the more that these people are going to be aware that they're white, the more they might self-consciously advocate for the interests of whites. I think it's going to have the opposite impact of what the original motivation was. And there's another question, by the way, which is if we organize our society in such a way that how people are treated and what benefits they get depends on the group of which they are a part, the inspiration for this, the hope of this might be to treat groups that have historically been subordinated better, to make sure that they can overcome those historical injustices. But what about our American history? Or what about our current reality makes us so sure that this is how it works out? If we really provoke a zero-sum battle over resources, pitting these different groups against each other, what makes us confident that it isn't the white majority, perhaps given voice to by the kind of far-right populists that remain very dangerous in our country, who win out those fights?
Do you see evidence of this happening already?
Well, first of all, there are hundreds and thousands of studies in psychology which show that if you prime people to think of themselves as a member of a particular group, they prioritize its interests over those of others. And this can be completely trivial. If I've done this with my students, have them debate whether or not a hot dog is a sandwich. The kids who think that a hot dog is a sandwich then in a distribution game start to discriminate against the kids who think that a hot dog is not a sandwich. People who prefer the painter Klee can be induced to discriminate against thinkers, against people who prefer the painter Kandinsky. We've had plenty of examples of this. I think there's also some empirical evidence of this in the United States. We actually see an interesting gender divergence in political views among younger Americans. A lot of young boys are actually trending towards the Republican Party in interesting ways. And I think that is motivated in part by that sense that on every kind of identity divide, they are grouped into the set of people who are responsible for historical injustice and who should be ashamed of themselves. And I think in some of those boys, that has created the instinct to say, well, actually, let's be proud of that group and fight and argue in favor of its interests rather than against it. And we see internationally that a lot of young people are attracted by these kind of far-right populists, that it is not always the oldest people who are tempted by these kinds of movements. So yes, I would say that there is all kinds of empirical evidence, both at a more theoretical level and at a more immediate level for this contention.
You reject the claim that there is an impossibility of mutual comprehension. It's a quote from your book. This notion that a member of a privileged group will never be able to understand the experience of the member of an oppressed group. On what basis do you reject this concept?
Yeah. So I think that, as with many of these ideas, there's a plausible intuition that gets turned into an upshot which is wrong. The plausible intuition is that as a man, I don't know what it feels like to worry about taking the subway at 9 or 10 p.m. because you might be sexually harassed. As a white person, I don't know what it feels like for a lot of African-American men to walk down the street and worry that a policeman may stop and frisk them and may treat them violently. And I may never be able to know exactly what it feels like to walk in these shoes. But now we have a set of ideas and norms called standpoint theory, which I think takes that basic insight too far. It says, if we stand at different intersections of identity to each other, then we're never going to understand each other. And rather than trying to empathize with your experience, I should simply defer to your view. And therefore, what politicians should do is to speak for those kind of identity groups. Ayanna Pressley, the representative from Massachusetts in the United States Congress, has said that I don't want any more black politicians who are not a black voice. I don't want any more brown politicians who are not a brown voice. So what is wrong with that account of the world? Well, first of all, it pretends that all members of a group have something in common in ways that are unrealistic. It defines women, for example, by the fact that they often have more caregiving responsibilities. But some women don't have caregiving responsibilities, and they're single dads who have a lot of caregiving responsibilities. It claims that people who are oppressed have greater insight and have all the insight into the nature of injustice. And certainly they have important insights because of their experiences. But in some circumstances, it may actually be the people who are privileged who have different kinds of insights, precisely because they have access to the kinds of spaces in which oppression might be perpetuated. We need to have insights from both these sets of people to understand what's going on. Thirdly, it fails to distinguish between what philosophers call experiential knowledge and what they call propositional knowledge. So I may not know exactly what it feels like to worry taking the subway at 9 p.m., but I can understand a lot of the politically relevant upshots from that. I can recognize that this experience exists if I listen to you with an open mind, and I certainly think it is unjust. I certainly think that we shouldn't live in a society where women have to fear taking the subway more than men. So the politically communicable part of this is something I can understand. And so finally, I think the political upshot here is wrong, because there are no homogeneous groups. What is a black voice? Is a black voice Ayanna Pressley, or is a black voice Jim Clyburn, who has a very different kinds of politics? Mm-hmm. You know, when you say, just delegate your view to these groups, most Americans are not going to do that. And the ones that do are just going to pick people in those groups with whom they already agree. So the whole thing is a chimera. I think what we need is real empathy. But if somebody tells me about an injustice they've experienced, I listen to them with an open mind. I don't dismiss them. I don't say, well, I've never experienced that, so you must be wrong. I listen to them carefully. And then we build real political solidarity, which is to say, if you've experienced this and you faced those obstacles and those injustices, that goes against my own vision of a kind of country I want to build. And so I'm going to stand in solidarity with you for those important reasons of my own.
You also take on the left's worries about cultural appropriation. First, define cultural appropriation.
So cultural appropriation has become this label that we apply to a very broad range of circumstances in which members of one group are influenced by, inspired by the cultures, the artifacts, the music, the cuisine of members of other groups, particularly when one is deemed more privileged than the other.
There are real injustices, which you write about, resulting from cultural appropriation. In other words, when artists or creators from marginalized groups are cheated out of the credit they deserve for their creations, whether that's economic credit or even just attribution. But now you see the notion as being applied too broadly. Give me some examples.
Yeah, and I think the notion fails to explain what is actually unjust about those circumstances. So again, there's a very plausible intuition here that you go back to the 1950s and you have these white musicians being inspired by, sometimes just outright stealing the songs of black musicians. And they have huge careers and the black musicians languish in relative obscurity. And cultural appropriation as a label is seemingly attractive because it claims it can explain that injustice. I don't think it can. What was unjust about the 1950s was not that there was some, you know, white saxophonists playing jazz. It was that black musicians suffered from Jim Crow, were not able to travel across the South freely, were not able to perform in many concert venues, were not able to be signed by many major record labels. And so the idea of cultural appropriation gets what philosophers call the wrong-making feature of a situation wrong. And that's important because it then points in the wrong direction for how to remedy that injustice. Yeah. What would have made the situation more just? White musicians not playing jazz, or African-Americans having the same rights, the same opportunities, dismantling segregation, making sure that they can perform in those concert venues? That is the right solution. And all of this matters in part because so much of our culture is an amalgam of different influences. How we dress, our language, how we write words, how we write numbers. Every aspect of our culture is a product of past forms of quote-unquote cultural appropriation. So I think the fact that in America today, people from all over the world, of all of these different roots, influence each other, inspire each other, co-create, that's not something we should be afraid of in America, but something we should be proud of in America.
You've written that you'd prefer to abandon the term cultural appropriation and entirely replace it with discrimination.
Well, or different forms of injustice, right? I think basically whenever somebody says cultural appropriation, say, can I express what is supposedly wrong here in straightforward terms? If so, it's wrong. And if not,
straightforward terms,
then
meaning,
I shouldn't be worried about it.
Is this discrimination?
So is it discrimination? Is it intellectual property theft? If you're actually stealing the specific song of an individual, that's a violation of copyright. I'll give you one other example. A fraternity at Baylor University a number of years ago ran something called a Cinco de Drinco party. And students showed up for it, some wearing ponchos and sombreros, others wearing maids' outfits and construction vests. Now, this was offensive, right? It was communicating that Latinos somehow aren't supposedly good enough to be students at this university or to have white-collar jobs. It was a way of trying to put them in their place, right? But the concept of cultural appropriation completely fails to express this, because perhaps it was offensive to wear sombreros or ponchos. It was certainly offensive to wear maids' outfits and construction vests. But a maids' outfit is not part of Latino culture. If anything, it's part of Western culture. So what was wrong here? Well, it was that intent to mock.
Yeah.
That intent to send the signal that you don't belong. That's what was wrong. The concept of cultural appropriation can't explain what is wrong about turning up to a quote-unquote Cinco de Drinco party in a maid's outfit.
Yeah. You recognize that societies that embrace liberal values, equal opportunity, freedom of speech, self-determination, have still never fully succeeded in realizing those ideals perfectly. Make the case for why the belief that universal liberal values is a better organizing principle to achieve equal opportunity than this new ideology of identity synthesis, of progressive separatism.
Well, there's a number of responses to this. The first is that there's a fundamental debate in American history for the last 200 years of whether living up to these values is a better way of achieving progress or giving up on those values. And time and again, we've seen that progress has come at times when people demand inclusion under those kind of institutions. We've talked a lot about race, but take a case like sexual orientation. There was a big debate within the gay rights movement. Do we want to undermine bourgeois institutions like marriage by excluding us? Or do we want to be included under them? Are we going to win equal standing and respect in this society by saying to people, by what right are you excluding us from these kinds of protections that you enjoy just because I happen to love somebody of the same sex? It is that argument that brought us marriage for all. It's that argument that has brought a fundamental transformation in how sexual minorities are treated in this country. And the argument of people like Derek Bell that America is as racist today, or by certain gay rights organizations, that America is as homophobic today as it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, I think is just plain wrong. I mean, within your and my lifetime, Ellen DeGeneres had to leave her talk show because she publicly acknowledged having a girlfriend. The idea for all of the real injustices that Americans of all kinds of minority groups face today, that we haven't made progress on race, I think is honestly offensive. It's not offensive to us wonderful, courageous, noble Americans living today. It's offensive to the people who suffered from so much more extreme forms of injustice in the past. And it's important to get this right, because sometimes people say, if you are saying we've made progress, we think you're trying to minimize problems to wave them away. But if we want to know how to keep making progress, it's important whether we've been able to make progress over the past or not, because it'll point us in the right direction for how to do better. And I want to say another thing. look at the societies around the world, but for all of our flaws, most tolerant, most affluent, have the highest human development index, give the highest opportunities to citizens of all groups. The countries that are most attractive to immigrants from every corner of the world and every ethnic group in terms of where they say they want to migrate to. All of them are liberal democracies that are animated by these values. All of those countries are imperfect. All of these countries have things that they have to work on. My creed is a progressive one in the sense that I think we need to live up to our values. And that means bringing reality in closer alignment to them. But giving up on them, falsely concluding we haven't made progress and therefore we should disband in our institutions and embrace radically different principles that are unproven and that in many contexts have led to terrible conflicts between different groups would be a terrible mistake.
Political correctness was the subject of William F. Buckley Jr.'s debate in 1991. Of course, he hosted this program for 33 years. And he debated the danger he believed it posed to freedom of thought in American universities. Boston University President John Silber summed up the argument neatly.
What bothers me is how one maintains any function for the university when we reduce the pursuit of truth and the claim of the capacity of the human mind to transcend the individual and to know other minds, that people come up with the thesis that our knowledge is dependent upon our perspective as either a male or a female, as either a member of one race or another race, as a member of one class or another class, or as a person living in a certain period of history as opposed to another. It seems to me that denial of transcendence that is implied by all of these pronouncements is inimical to the very life of the mind and the very function of the university.
How are the 1990s PC debates connected to the identity trap?
I think there's certain similarities, but the ideology that is so influential today is different in certain important respects. And there is a real difference in the extent to which they dominate institutions. In the early 1990s, as you could see here, the university president confidently spoke out against them. That would be less likely today. In the 1990s, when we talked about political correctness, it was reserved to campus and perhaps a couple of activist spaces. Today, it's a topic in corporations, nonprofit organizations, in congressional offices. So I think the extent of its influence has changed as well.
Do they come from the same tradition? Is there a through line?
I think there is a through line. There are some similarities, but also some important differences, in particular in terms of its connection to public policy. I think at the time, these ideas were mostly around things like speech codes, around offensive language. And that certainly is a concern today as well. But most of my work, most of my book is not about so-called cancel culture. It is not about, I worry about those things. I worry about maintaining a culture of free speech. But I think in terms of the influence this now has on public policy, these examples like the COVID vaccines, in terms of educational practices, like separating young kids into different racial groups, that didn't exist in the same form in the early 1990s.
You say there's still time to get us out of the identity trap. You have concrete suggestions for how to combat it. How much time do we have and how do you do it?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is, I'm a small D Democrat in the sense that unlike many people today, I believe in the wisdom of citizens and voters. They get some things wrong sometimes. It would be strange to think that you always agree with whatever the majority says in some opinion poll. But I think most Americans are pretty reasonable in how we think about our country and our history. Most Americans think, for example, that we should, of course, teach children about the history of slavery and other racial injustice. And we should also, of course, honor people like George Washington as great Americans. You can think both of those things at the same time, even though in our public debate, it often appears that we can't. And so the best way to fight back against these ideas is to claim the moral high ground, to show how they are rooted in a long and noble political tradition but goes from people like Frederick Douglass through Abraham Lincoln to Martin Luther King Jr. in discussions, not to be overly nervous in making this case, not to be making excuses and say, I'm so sorry to be arguing against this. Then you just look guilty. And not to be a jerk either, not to say, you're going to hate what I say anyway, so I may as well just throw you a barb, but calmly argue for your ideals. Because certainly for myself, I might be wrong about everything I've said today. We all might be wrong about what we believe. But it is my deepest conviction for how to build a better country. And that is the spirit in which we should be making those arguments. And when you do, I don't think you should be too concerned about the consequences that that might have.
You also say don't become a reactionary.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I think that there's a tendency in politics to think that the enemy of your enemy is your friend. And there are certainly many people on the right of our politics who exploit fears about wokeness or fears about critical race theory in order to say, well, we shouldn't teach children about the history of slavery, or we shouldn't teach them to be tolerant towards sexual minorities. We reject every form of politics and every form of cultural norm that would build a kinder society in which we treat each other with respect. And that is a genuinely dangerous reaction, and a genuinely wrong reaction to these trends we're talking about. So don't be a reactionary, which basically means saying the opposite of anything somebody believes you don't like or don't agree with. Be rooted in your own convictions and moral tradition. For me, that is the philosophical liberalism of the people we've been speaking about. For others, it may be conservatism, or it may be Marxism, it may be Buddhism, or it may be Christianity. But show how your values, your aspirations are rooted in your principles and argue on the basis of those.
Since you mentioned it, Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis and Vivek Ramaswamy have made a war on wokeness seminal to their presidential aspirations and campaigns. How do you distinguish, as you make the case for this argument for the identity synthesis, how do you distinguish your critiques from the arguments pushed by anti-woke activists on the right?
Well, first of all, I think that they operate in bad faith and attack things that are important, but are part of a decent society. And secondly, they embrace remedies that would further undermine our liberties. They are right that in many universities, there is an insufficiently tolerant culture for heterodox views, for people who disagree. But what people like Ron DeSantis then do is to try and legislate what can be said and what can't be said in public universities in Florida. I teach students about some of the themes we've been talking about today. I have a seminar in which I have a week on cultural appropriation and a week on free speech. And the way that I think of my role and duty as a college teacher is to give my students the tools to argue for either side of this debate. I tell them on the first day of class, I want you to change your mind about something. You can change your mind in this direction or that direction. I would rather you make a smart argument I disagree with than to echo my words back to me. And so obviously, as part of this, I assign people who would count as part of a tradition of critical race theory, of identity politics. And according to legislation in the state of Florida, that means that my course would be illegal in a public university in that state. That is, as the founding fathers would have said, a cure worse than the disease. That's not going to recreate a culture of free speech. It's simply going to balkanize America into two halves, in which in one half you're allowed to say one set of things, and the other half you're allowed to say a different set of things. I want an America in which in all of it, you're allowed to speak your mind.
So what you're saying is Governor DeSantis is actually promoting the same solution that the progressive separatists are promoting as well.
The people who've inspired his policies are in some cases explicitly emulating some of those measures, saying, well, if you're restricting what can be said through a speech code on this campus, we are going to restrict it in the state of Florida through actual legislation in our legislature. That is morally and strategically the wrong response.
You wrote in 2016, quote, Under Trump, the Republican Party has completed its decades-long transition towards being a vehicle for white identity politics. Do you still believe the Republican Party is a vehicle for white identity politics in this country?
I think it is in large parts. What is interesting, though, is that Donald Trump's brand of politics seems to have succeeded in making the Republican Party more racially diverse. But actually today, knowing what ethnic group a voter hails from tells you less about who they're going to vote for than it did in 2016.
Not remarkably, though. I mean, single digit percentage points of African Americans.
African Americans are still voting
for
Democrats in the great majority. With Latinos, there has been a remarkable shift from a 2-to-1 dominance.
States, though?
No, it's often said that this is mostly in Florida because of Cubans and so on. It's the case in Texas with a very different population of Latinos who don't come from former communist countries like Venezuela or
But it
Cuba.
Is the case that it's Florida and Texas.
No, it's you see it.
Do you see it in California? Do you see it amongst Hispanics
yes,
in California?
Yes, I believe so. You see it across the country. It's most visible in places where Latinos are most concentrated, which tend to be in places like Texas and Florida. But you
All
do see the trend in parts of the country. So I do think that the one positive trend we've had in our politics over the last 10 years, I mean, many terrible trends, and I'm very concerned about our democratic institutions. But one positive trend is that this great prediction that a lot of people had, a lot of people on the Democratic side had, that as America becomes more diverse, as there's fewer white voters proportionally who used to vote for the Republican Party and more non-white voters who tended to vote for the Democratic Party, Democrats are going to have this natural demographic majority. That is
turned out to be a fallacy.
Yeah. Florida is now close to being a majority minority state, and it's moved from being a purple state to being a significantly red state. And even though I certainly prefer the Democratic Party to the Republican Party at this juncture in American history, I think that's a good development because I don't want to live in a country where I can look at the color of your skin and predict who you're going to vote for. That would be a very dangerous setup for our ability to keep the peace and to see each other as genuine compatriots. So the fact that our politics, for all of its nastiness, has been depolarizing by race, that knowing a voter's identity gives you less information about who they're going to vote for, is a positive trend.
You've labeled Trump as a, quote, existential threat to our political system, and expressed concerns that a Trump second term would be far worse than a Trump first term. In The Identity Trap, you pivot to critiquing the modern progressive movement, and you call this an urgent topic. Explain the urgency.
Well, there's a number of things. First, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I don't think because there's one thing we should worry about, we all have some obligation to shut up about the other thing. What's normatively wrong, what's substantively wrong. I also think it is wrong in practical terms. One of the things that have allowed these ideas to become so dominant is that after Trump won in 2016, it became taboo to criticize these ideas on big parts of the left. But one of the reasons why Donald Trump is now once again running head-to-head with Joe Biden in polls for 2024 is that a lot of voters are concerned about the dominance that these ideas have over mainstream institutions. I don't share this judgment, but more Americans right now think the Democratic Party is too extreme than think that the Republican Party is too extreme. There was recently an analysis in the New York Times which shows that there's a key new voting demographic in the Republican Party, about 10% of its voters, who are predominantly young, predominantly non-white, predominantly quite progressive on all kinds of social issues, but concerned about the hold of what they call woke ideas have over our institutions and businesses and other associations. That 10% of people who are currently voting for the Republican Party could very well make the difference between the genuinely dangerous Donald Trump winning in 2024 and him failing to recapture the White House.
You've studied the threats to democracy on the right, You've shifted your focus to the cultural excesses on the left. Which is the greater threat, or the more urgent threat to our democracy?
The greater threat comes from the political power of the far right. But I do think that the cultural influence of the identity trap is making it much more likely that people like Donald Trump will win back political office. And so it's tempting to say we need to choose between opposing one or the other. And at a superficial level, these ideologies don't share that much in common. But in practical and political terms, one is the yin to the other's yang. If we want to effectively oppose one, it helps to oppose both.
Yasha Monk, thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thank you so much.